You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Connection Between the Living and the Dead, Collected Works, Volume 168. And this is lecture number 4, entitled How Can Today's Poverty of Soul Be Overcome? Given in Zurich, October 10th, 1916. What we seek as spiritual scientific truths should not be just a dead knowledge for us, but a living one. It should be knowledge that can really find its way into our life, into all aspects of our life, and at the most important points in our life. Spiritual science today is often taken in quite abstractly. And people, especially those who have little understanding of spiritual science, may even come to a sort of detached knowledge that initially proves to be unfruitful for life, and they then have the following impression. Quote, what does it matter that we know human beings are made of so-and-so many parts or members, and that humanity has evolved through different cultural epochs and will continue to evolve, and so on? Close quote. For those who believe, according to today's demands, that people should be completely present in practical life, spiritual science often seems quite unproductive. And it is often conveyed as being unproductive, even by those who already have some heart and feeling for it. Nevertheless, spiritual science itself, as it is something infinitely full of life. It can come alive even in the most exoteric practices in life, and it also must come alive for the sake of the future. Today I would like to make this clear with a particular example by choosing something from our spiritual science that we all presumably know, that is well known to us, and to show how it will gradually become even more enlivened by our looking at it as being full of life. Most of you will have heard before that our time was preceded by the so-called fourth post-Atlantean cultural period, in which the Greeks and Romans were the most important peoples. The impulses of this fourth post-Atlantean cultural period influenced the following centuries into the 14th and 15th centuries. We have been in the fifth post-Atlantean cultural period since the 15th century. We have been born into this period in our current incarnation, and human beings will live in this fifth cultural period for many centuries to come. We know furthermore, and have often let it flow through our souls, at least most of us have, that humanity particularly advanced outer culture and outer work during the fourth post-Atlantean, the Greco-Roman cultural period, which developed the so-called intellectual or mind-soul at that time. Our task now is to develop the consciousness soul. What does it mean that the consciousness soul must be developed? Understood correctly, what was just introduced in abstract form will constitute the fate of humanity for our entire fifth post-Atlantean cultural period. The different peoples of this fifth cultural period must work together to give expression to the consciousness soul. This shows in all life's conditions and circumstances. If we look at life rightly, the truth is confirmed for us everywhere that our time represents the actualization of the consciousness soul. Human life was entirely different in the Greco-Roman period. Then, at the level at which humanity stood in the fourth post-Atlantean period, humanity was given the power of reason and the power of the feeling soul, in German Gemüt. Reason is something that includes many things. We no longer look at it so exactly today. The Greeks and Romans were dependent on their reason in a different way from people of today's fifth cultural period. As part of their natural state of evolution, the Greeks and Romans received reason to the extent they needed it. Just as today, natural dispositions develop as human beings mature, in a certain way, natural reason developed then in them. This was very different from the way it is today. People then did not have to develop natural reason in the same way as is necessary today, and which will become more and more necessary in our fifth period. It developed then as a natural ability. People either had reason, if they developed in natural conditions, or they did not. If they did not, it was something pathological. It was also exceptional. It was not usual. It was the same with the feeling soul, which developed in the way appropriate to the fourth post-Atlantean period. When people encountered each other, they knew how to adapt themselves to the other person. History does not tell us much of such things, but it was so. In this respect, there is a particularly great difference between the people of the earlier centuries up through the 15th century and the people of our time. The people of those early centuries did not pass by each other indifferently, as is often the case today. Today, when people meet, they often need a long time to really get to know each other. We each have to learn about the other person to begin to trust each other until we gain each other's trust. What is achieved today only after long acquaintance, and even then is often not achieved, was achieved instantly when people met each other in the Greco-Roman cultural period. Individualities coming together developed relationships very quickly. They did not need to exchange thoughts and feelings for a long time. A person's mind worked in a much more spiritual way, into another person's mind. Relationships were made very quickly, insofar as they served the well-being of the two people involved, or insofar as this was necessary in some way for a number of people who formed a group. Today we can correctly identify the colors of plants with our senses, but in the seventh post-Atlantean cultural period, people will no longer be able to do so without effort. Instead, certain circumstances will be necessary to even become acquainted with nature. Just as we can recognize plants immediately from the first impression today, and not just through closer contact, so it was then in relation to other people. We must remember that this kind of mind connection between people was completely appropriate for that fourth post-Atlantean period. However, it sufficed only for the simpler living conditions of that time. Today, a much different web of feeling connections extends over the world than was the case then. Just imagine that most of people's relationships in the fourth cultural era, by far, were based on personal encounters, and that whatever people had to work out together was worked out through personal encounters. Printing, which belongs to the fifth post-Atlantean cultural era, has enabled impersonal contact with others, and this will be increasingly so in our time. Modern transportation brings people together in such a way that relationships are formed quickly, and might actually not be beneficial at all. Thus, through these modern means of interaction, people encounter each other much more impersonally in the world. As a result, the constitution of human beings now is such that it does not receive as fully developed either the mind with its ability to work instantly, or the intellect with its penetrating effect, as was the case with the intellectual or mind-soul. Rather, humanity is being developed by the consciousness soul, making us much more separate and individual, leading more to egotism and to awareness of our isolation within our own body. Because of our consciousness soul, we are now more separate as individuals, hermits who wander through the world, than we were with the intellectual or mind-soul. The fact that people have closed themselves off has already become the most important characteristic of our time, and will become so more and more. The consciousness soul leads us to closing ourselves off from the rest of humanity, to being more isolated. Thus, it is quite difficult to get to know others, and especially to become close with them, to become familiar with others, and to develop trust requires a lengthy process of first getting to know the other person. So what then is all of this supposed to achieve? We will best be able to understand this if we contemplate thoroughly a certain spiritual scientific truth, which tells us that the way we come together today is not coincidental, truly not coincidental. Our life path brings us together with certain people, and does not bring us together with others. Today, because we have entered a period in human evolution that in a certain way has brought the earlier karmic developments people have experienced to a high point, whom we meet is completely based on the effects of each person's karma. Just imagine how much less karma people had accumulated at the beginning of earthly evolution. Every time we incarnate, new karma is formed. Human beings at first encountered one another on earth without having been together before. At that time, they needed to develop new relationships. But by being incarnated again and again in the world, we have entered into so many relationships that as a rule we now actually encounter only people with whom we have had some experience in earlier incarnations. We are brought together with people through what we have experienced in earlier incarnations. It seems, in quotes, coincidental when people meet one another. In truth, it is all based on meetings from earlier incarnations when the forces were generated so that these people are now brought together again in a certain way. Now, the self-contained consciousness soul that must develop in our time can develop only when we give less attention to what plays out person to person in the present and allow the things that rise within us mysteriously as a result of previous incarnations to take effect. In Greco-Roman times, it was still the case that when two people met, each person immediately made an impression on the other, and the impression had a very strong effect. Now, so that the more isolated consciousness soul in people can develop, it should be more like this. One person meets another, and what emerges as a result of previous incarnations should gradually become more effective. This takes longer than immediate acquaintance at first sight. It implies that people, little by little, let what they have experienced with the other come up instinctively, feelingly. That is exactly what is called for today, that we get to know each other gradually, so that the sharp edges of our current outer personalities are smoothed down. For in this way of becoming acquainted, in this smoothing down of our individuality, lies the rise of still unconscious, instinctive reminiscences, the consequences of our previous incarnations. And only when people thus enter into a relationship with others from out of their own inner being can the consciousness soul develop. Whereas the intellectual or mind soul develops through the insightful getting to know one another of an outer encounter. In this way, individuals are correctly integrated with each other. What I have just characterized for you is only just beginning in the fifth post-Atlantean era. As this era progresses, people will find it more and more difficult to relate to each other correctly, because bringing ourselves into relationships correctly requires inner development, inner activity. These difficulties have already begun, and they will spread ever further and become more and more intensive. How difficult it has already become today for people who have been brought together through karma to understand each other immediately. Perhaps because of other karmic circumstances, they do not find the strength to develop an instinctive feeling for all the karmic connections that come from previous incarnations. People are brought together. They love each other. This is the result of certain effects from previous incarnations. But other forces work in opposition when such a reminiscence comes up, and people go their separate ways again. Those who meet in life in this way are not the only ones who must test whether what rises within them is really sufficient to establish a lasting relationship. It is also becoming more and more difficult for sons and daughters to understand fathers and mothers, for parents to understand their children, for siblings to understand each other. Mutual understanding is becoming more and more difficult because it is becoming increasingly necessary for people to really let arise out of their inner being what exists there karmically. You see what a negative perspective this opens for the fifth post-Atlantean era, the difficulty in people's mutual understanding of each other. However, this difficulty necessitates that we squarely face this requirement of evolution, that we not wish to live on dreamily in the dark, because this requirement of evolution is absolutely necessary. Were it not imposed on humanity that getting to know one another is so difficult in this era, the consciousness soul would not be able to develop, and people would have to live together according to their natural dispositions. Then the individuality of the consciousness soul would not be able to develop. Thus, human beings must go through this test. This must be faced squarely, because, of course, if only this negative side of the requirements of evolution in our fifth post-Atlantean era came about, then war and conflicts would occur, even in the most superficial relationships. Thus, we are seeing in this time a certain number of needs arising instinctively, which must be overcome ever more consciously. And to overcome them more and more consciously is one of the tasks of spiritual science for humanity. I need only mention one term, and it will immediately dawn on each of us that a remedy is being sought for the difficulty of mutual understanding that is necessarily arising. I need only mention the term. More and more a sense for social understanding must be awakened in this fifth post-Atlantean era and awakened consciously, because we live in the age of the consciousness soul. That one term summarizes needs that were by no means present to the same degree during the fourth post-Atlantean era. Whoever is able really to study the structures of Greek and Roman cultures knows that individualism was not such a predisposition within humanity then as it is now in European, or even in the European-dependent, American peoples. You will grasp this particularly if you compare human beings to animals. In order to compare, we will use a radical example. Why does an animal species live together within certain boundaries? Because it is predisposed to do so, as a result of its group soul, its species soul. Animal species are born with a group soul. That is a matter of course, but they cannot grow out of it. They remain in it. Human beings must grow beyond the group soul. Every single person must develop individually, and especially in the present day, the consciousness soul is one of the essential parts of this individual development. There is certainly still a trace of the group soul aspect in Greek and Roman cultures. We see that people were also still within a social order that had a definite form, even though its structure, its form, came about largely through moral forces. But these forms are being dissolved more and more in the fifth post-Atlantean era. The trace of the group soul aspect, which still remained in the fourth era, no longer has meaning in this fifth era. In its place, however, social understanding must arise consciously. That is, all that comes from a deeper understanding of the truly individual human essence must arise. Only spiritual science can develop this true understanding. When spiritual science develops more and more from the abstract to what is concrete and full of life, within the circles that follow spiritual science, a very special sort of knowledge of and interest in humanity will be awakened. There will be those who have certain capacities to teach their fellow human beings about how people have different temperaments and dispositions. How the person who has a particular temperament should be understood. How another person who has a certain disposition, a certain temperament, must be understood differently. Thus people with this particular social talent will teach other people who are ready to learn. Quote, there is this type of person, there is another type of person, and we must look at the one person thus and the other person so. Close quote. Practical psychology, practical knowledge of the soul, but also a practical knowledge of life will be developed, and through this a true social understanding of the evolution of humanity will result. What has appeared until now as social understanding? Abstract ideals have appeared, the most varied abstract ideals about world and national happiness, this or that form of socialism. If we really tried to introduce into the world such social ideas as are appearing here and there, we would soon see that we cannot accomplish it. Social understanding is not in any way about founding societies or sects with certain agendas, but about spreading knowledge of the human being, practical knowledge of human nature. This means knowledge of the human being that enables us to correctly understand nascent, developing human beings, to understand children correctly and the way they each develop with their own individuality. Through this, we learn to become part of life in such a way that we develop correct, lasting relationships, relationships that can really become fruitful for life. This comes about through the correct karmic effects within us. When, because of karma, we come face to face with a person with whom we are supposed to have a particular relationship. Practical knowledge of the human being, a practical, effective interest in humanity, is what this depends on. Humanity today has still not come very far at all in this way. It is still very limited in its progress. So how do we react when we meet a person today? We may react with sympathy or antipathy to the person. Go anywhere in the world and see how this is the only reaction in most cases. Even when we meet many people, our reactions are completely controlled by this one point of view, quote, I like him, I don't like her, close quote, or, quote, I like that about her, I don't like that about him, close quote. Preconceived notions. We imagine that a person should actually be a certain way, and when we see anything different in a person, then we make a judgment about the person. Until this sort of thinking stops, of thinking of others as sympathetic or antipathetic based on our prejudices, on certain personal preferences that we have about human nature, and until the attitude spreads of taking people as they are, we will not be able to make strides in true practical knowledge of human nature. Just think how very often today two people come face to face under these circumstances, and some antipathy arises in one of them. One does not like the other. Then everything that the one person does in relation to the other is colored by this dislike. Through this, a karmic relationship is very often totally wiped out, completely put on the wrong track. And it can be put right only in the next incarnation when these people come together again. Sympathies and antipathies are the greatest enemies of true social interest, but this fact is seldom even noticed. Those who know what true social understanding means for the advancement of humanity observe at times with a terribly heavy heart the effect teachers can have in a school. Because of certain prejudices, teachers may think from the outset of one pupil as nice or not nice compared to another. That is often terrible. Whereas it is really about taking every person, quote, as is, close quote, and making the very best from it. However, it is the attitude, based on sympathy and antipathy, that enters our institutions. Our institutions, our social rules, which often extinguish teachers' individualities, are already such that in reality individuality cannot even be addressed. True understanding for spiritual science must take such effect that practical psychology and practical knowledge of the human being become part of the common interest. These are necessary for social understanding, so that we can create the polar opposite of the difficulty of understanding each other. This is what must appear most particularly in the fifth post-Atlantean era for humanity to fully develop the consciousness soul. To a certain extent, people must experience everything through tests, where counter forces stand in their way. Thus the feelings of sympathy and antipathy will spread, and only through battling, conscious battling of superficial feelings of sympathy and antipathy, will the consciousness soul really be able to be born. In the same way, person-to-person social understanding will more and more overcome nationalistic feelings and perceptions that now exist. Nationalist feelings, which essentially first got out of hand in their current form in the 19th century, most significantly oppose social understanding, true person-to-person interest. And so these national, in quotes, opposites, national feelings of sympathy and antipathy, arise today. They represent a difficult, terrible test for humanity, because well-being can come only from overcoming them. If the feelings of sympathy and antipathy that come from national perspectives were to get further out of hand, as they have started to do, humanity would dream away the evolution of the consciousness soul. This is because national feelings go in the opposite direction. They do not let human beings become self-sufficient, but make us so that we appear only as a poor imitation, a reflection of a group nature or nationality. The first thing we must contemplate practically when we put this otherwise abstract thought before our souls is that especially the consciousness soul must particularly begin to evolve in this fifth post-Atlantean era. Something further must begin in this era if the consciousness soul is to truly develop. If religious life will not adapt to the fifth post-Atlantean era, but chooses rather to remain as was correct for the previous period, a certain stultification, a true deadening of religious life will begin as we become more and more individual. Group religions had to come about during the fourth post-Atlantean era because people were more invested with the group nature. Commonalities in dogmas, commonalities in religious principles and religious thought had to be, as it were, poured out by force over groups of people. However, because the impulse to individuality will become ever stronger by means of the consciousness soul in our present era, what is expressed through group religions will no longer penetrate to our hearts, to the individuality of each soul. People will simply not understand what comes from group religions. In fourth post-Atlantean times, people could be taught about Christ in groups. In the fifth post-Atlantean age, Christ is, in fact, entering into individual souls. We all carry Christ in our unconscious or subconscious already. But he must first be brought again to consciousness within us. That does not happen when established, rigid, lifeless dogmas are imposed upon people. It happens rather when everything possible is attempted to make Christ understandable to all people and to foster religious knowledge for all. Thus, more and more tolerance must come about, directly in relation to the thinking of religious life. It must come about in this fifth post-Atlantean era. The situation in the fourth post-Atlantean age was still such that those who worked for religion imparted a certain number of dogmas, of set principles, to their fellow human beings. This must become much different in the fifth post-Atlantean era. It is quite a different matter now. Now, because people are becoming ever more individual, religious life should support the attempt to become completely free from dogma, should really bring before people the things that can be explained, can be described to others without dogma. This will come about more from personal inner experience, so that people can individually develop their own free religious thought life. In reality, the religions with dogmas, with specific set dogmas and tenets, will kill religious life in the fifth post-Atlantean era. Thus, the correct way to begin in this era is to make it more understandable to people that whereas in the first centuries of Christianity, dogmas and tenets were especially suited to people, something else has become appropriate in the centuries that followed. But there are also other religions. One attempts to describe the nature of other religions, and one attempts to clarify various views concerning Christ. In this way, we bring to each soul what will deepen it. But we do not try to shape their souls ourselves. We allow them to have their freedom of thought, particularly in the field of religion, in order to further develop this freedom of thought. Just as social understanding is necessary on the one hand, as I have described it, so on the other hand, freedom of thought in the field of religion is a basic requirement for the development of the consciousness soul. Social understanding in the field of social existence. Freedom of thought in the field of religion, of religious life. What we are attempting to do is to increasingly understand religious life, to penetrate it, and thus be able to get along with our fellow human beings, even if each person develops their own religious life. This must be considered evermore, because it is one basic requirement for the fifth post-Atlantean era, something that humanity must consciously acquire for itself. Specifically, in the age of the consciousness soul, the Ahrimanic forces directly attack this freedom of thought most of all. We see how denominations everywhere antagonistically regard the foundation of the spiritual scientific stream, the spread of freedom of thought. We see how much slander and libel are directed at spiritual science for the simple reason that spiritual science is trying to examine the birth of the consciousness soul with full, light-filled understanding. Spiritual science does not want to spread the sort of religious life that is still built on the spreading and promoting of the intellectual or mind soul, as was the case in the fourth post-Atlantean era. The forms of Christianity in that era were based on the needs of the Greco-Roman culture. Those forms are already unsuited as forms for churches now, and they will become increasingly unsuitable for allowing freedom of thought to arise, as this freedom must emerge. At the same time, when the need for freedom of thought first began to stir out of modern life, an opposing power also set to work immediately. This could be called the, in quotes, Jesuitism of the different religions, though much is included in this term that must be described in detail separately. This was actually brought to life in order to provide the strongest resistance to the freedom of thought that is a necessity of life in this era. And it will become increasingly necessary to eradicate this Jesuitism, which is opposed to freedom of thought in all areas in our era, because the freedom of thought radiating from religious life must continue to develop in all areas of life. But since this freedom of thought must be acquired independently, humanity is essentially being put to a test, and the greatest difficulties crop up everywhere. These difficulties become that much greater because the people of our epoch must also develop clarity of consciousness. At first, people experience the need for freedom as uncomfortable, and then anesthetize themselves in many ways. Thus we see that an intense struggle exists between the burgeoning of freedom of thought and the authority from former times that is still holding on in our time. The anesthetizing obsession of abandoning ourselves to deception through faith in authority is present. Faith in authority has grown immensely and has become very intensive. Under its influence, human beings have developed a certain helplessness in regard to exercising their faculty of judgment. In the fourth post-Atlantean era, healthy understanding was provided to humanity as a natural gift. Now we must acquire it, develop it ourselves. Faith in authority holds us back. But we become completely caught up in this faith in authority. Just think how people appear helpless compared to creatures that have no power of reason. Animals have many instincts that lead them in beneficial ways from sickness back to health, whereas humanity today works hard against common sense regarding sickness and health. In this way, humanity today submits completely to authority. It is not easy for modern humanity to even form an opinion regarding healthy living conditions. Certainly, all sorts of organizations and such make laudable endeavors, but these endeavors must all become much more intensive. Above all, we must understand that we are continuously moving toward a faith in authority, and that entire theories are formed that are themselves the foundation of views that strengthen this same faith in authority. In the field of medicine, in the field of jurisprudence, and in all other fields as well, people declare themselves incompetent from the start in acquiring and understanding, and they simply accept the word of science. This is indeed understandable, given the complexity of modern life. But people will become increasingly more helpless under the influence of the power of such authority. Systematically cultivating this authority, this disposition for authority, actually is the principle of Jesuitism. And Jesuitism in the Catholic religion is only one specific example of the results, which also appear in other fields, but which we simply do not notice. Jesuitism first began to uphold the power of the papacy in the field of ecclesiastical doctrine, which carried over from the fourth post-Atlantean period into the fifth. But the papacy is no longer suited for the fifth period. This same Jesuit principle, however, is also carried over again and again into other areas of life. Today we can see Jesuitism looming even over the medical field, which is essentially nothing other than Jesuitism transferred from dogmatic religion. We see how from a sort of medical dogmatism, doctors strive for an increase in the power of their status as doctors. And that striving for power is the essential thing about the Jesuit-like aspiration for power in various other fields as well. This will become ever stronger. People will become increasingly more constricted by what authority imposes upon them. And well-being for our fifth post-Atlantean era will consist of asserting the right of the consciousness soul, which wants to develop against this Ahrimanic opposition, for this is indeed what it is. This can take place, however, only when people really desire to develop understanding and a healthy ability to exercise judgment. In our time, we do not receive, as we do our two arms, natural understanding at birth, which was comparatively still the case in the fourth post-Atlantean period. The development of the consciousness soul requires freedom of thought, but this freedom of thought can thrive only in a very specific aura, in a very specific atmosphere. I have pointed out to you the difficulties present in our own era, because it is moving in a very specific direction of development, toward the development of the consciousness soul. But this consciousness soul, precisely because it must develop as a consciousness soul, must have opposition. It must endure tests. Thus we see that great opposition arises to both social understanding and freedom of thought. Today people do not understand at all that this opposition exists. In many circles, the opposition is regarded as exactly the right impulse, which should very specifically not be counteracted, but instead should be developed. However, there are many, many people who have an open heart and good understanding for where modern human beings find themselves, who have an open mind and a good understanding for what can already be seen today. They understand the karmic situation of the crisis I have just described, how children no longer understand their parents, parents no longer understand their children, siblings no longer understand each other, and different peoples no longer understand each other. There are already enough people today to confront this situation, which is necessary, but which can be turned to the good only through truly heartfelt understanding. For the impulse for this new work for the world must flow consciously from the blood of the heart. The estrangement of individuals from one another will come about independently. What will have to stream forth from human hearts must be sought consciously. For only in the overcoming of these difficulties will the trials arise through which the consciousness soul can be developed. Today one hears many people saying, quote, "Oh, I don't have a feeling for what I should make of myself. I don't know how I fit into the world." Close quote. This is the result of their not yet having found the opportunity to reflect clearly on what is needed today, and on how human beings are part of that. Many people today develop dependent relationships to the point of physical illness, to the point of physical instability. A real understanding of this is increasingly and ever more intensively demanded. This is due to that which will necessarily pour out over humanity in the fifth post-Atlantean era, the danger of soul poverty. Soul poverty in the sense of what has been said today. Many people see what I have described and feel it is necessary, really necessary, for people to come to social understanding, on the one hand, and freedom of thought, on the other, but few are willing to take the correct measures. People often attempt to promote what is necessary for social understanding with all kinds of idealistic-sounding phrases. So much is being written today on the necessity of individual treatment for the young, growing human being. What elaborate theories are being conceived in all possible pedagogical fields? That is not what this is about. What should be spread widely, and in an understanding way, are what I would like to call positive natural histories of individual human development, as many descriptions as possible of how a human being has developed. Wherever we can, we should say how person A, person B, and person C have developed, and enter lovingly into the details of an individual's development taking place before us. This is necessary above all. A study of life, the will to study life, and not simply to follow a program, because theoretical programs are the enemy of the fifth post-Atlantean cultural period. When societies arise, they should arise in accordance with the fifth post-Atlantean cultural period, so that the people who come together in these societies are of main importance. And what can result from the mutual association of these positive-minded people can indeed come about. Truly individual effects will result from this if we pay attention to them. What do we usually do today? First, we pass statutes and regulations. Indeed, this can be a very good thing, and is maybe even necessary, since outer circumstances demand outer regulation. But we must be clear in our field that all talk of plans and statutes is only a concession to the world, that the issue is really that living together individually must arise from people with a positive attitude so that mutual understanding is attained. Then the possibility will present itself in this fifth post-Atlantean era, we have hundreds of years ahead of us, that the understanding of individual development of development that is full of life, will issue forth from the circle of those who understand it into the wider world, which today ties up everything into paragraphs like a Spanish boot, into sections or laws or something similar. Thus teachings that sound as if they are healing are popping up everywhere from the pulpits and from other speakers' platforms, which are supposed to instruct us about life. We see teachings appearing everywhere that simply ooze with abstractions, and in which people are presented with all manner of ideas and ideals. This cannot be what genuine change is really about. Rather, it is a matter of penetrating concrete real life with understanding. Now, how can this be done? Some argue, and of course absolutely rightly so, that we can't learn to judge everything that comes from authority today. Just think, they will say, what someone has to learn who wants to become a doctor. It is right that this person should learn it. We cannot learn that and learn what a lawyer learns and also learn what artists learn and so on. We simply cannot do it. Of course we cannot do that without question. But we do need to be able to learn all of these things. We do not need to be able to learn all these things. We need only to be able to judge. We must become capable of leaving authority to its work, but also of judging authority. We will not learn to do so by really going into every single speciality, but rather by acquiring the ability to judge from a foundation that can develop our understanding, our power of judgment, comprehensively. This can never come from material understanding of each specialty, but rather from comprehensive spiritual knowledge. Spiritual science must be the central knowledge, because spiritual science will not only give clarity to the relationships in human evolution, it will also, because of the nature of its thoughts and ideas, develop healthy understanding in us, which today must be brought up from great depths, just as it had to be brought out in the Greco-Roman cultural period, the fourth cultural period. The way of developing concepts, developing ideas, which is necessary for spiritual science, is different from other sciences. It does not enable us to become an authority in every field, but rather to become discriminating. And we will realize more and more why that is so, because there are mysterious forces in the human soul. These mysterious forces will bond the human soul and the spiritual world by our delving into spiritual science and by being discriminating when we encounter authority. We will not know everything an authority knows, but if the authority does a particular thing in an individual situation, we will be capable of judging that. We must particularly emphasize this as something that must be brought about through spiritual science, so that it does not just teach people, but also enables them to exercise good judgment in this regard. That is, it first gives them the possibility of freedom of thought, first fosters independent thought in them. Spiritual science does not make us into physicians, but if we penetrate spiritual science correctly, spiritual science enables us to judge what is brought into public life by physicians. Once people understand what I mean by these words, then they will understand much about the healing forces for this era. It is really significant when I say that spiritual science will transform human understanding so that people will become discriminating, and the power of understanding is freed up out of their soul life. Only in this way can they truly achieve freedom of thought. If I may now speak somewhat pictorially, I would like to describe these thoughts to you in a pictorial imaginative form. In spiritual science, we hear of the true spiritual world, the concrete spiritual world of elemental beings that surround us. We hear of hierarchies, angels, archangels, and so on. For us, the world is populated with concrete spiritual content, with spiritual forces and spiritual beings. These beings that live in the spiritual worlds it is not insignificant that we know about them. In the fourth post-Atlantean period, these beings were more or less indifferent to the thoughts of human beings about them. But in the fifth post-Atlantean period, they are no longer indifferent. Now, when human beings here on earth know nothing of them, it is as if they are deprived of a kind of spiritual food. The spiritual world is absolutely connected to our physical earthly world. You will understand this best if I tell you something that may itself seem paradoxical to you, but which simply is true. After all, although many things cannot be said today, some truths must be spoken, because people should not live without these truths. You see, a correct point of view for the people who live here on earth is to know that Christ entered into earthly life through the mystery of Golgotha, and since then he has been part of earthly life. And from a certain perspective, one can see Christ's coming as fortunate for earthly life. But now, put yourself in the position of the angels. And this position is no invention of mine. This position is what comes to light as something real for the true esoteric researcher. Put yourself in the place of the angels. They experienced something different in their spiritual sphere. They had the opposite experience. Christ went away from their sphere to go to humanity. He left their sphere. They must have said among themselves, quote, "Christ went away from our world through the mystery of Golgotha," close quote. They have just as much reason to feel sad about Christ leaving their realm as human beings living in a physical body feel Christ's coming to them as beneficial. This is a real thought process. Anyone who really knows the spiritual world knows that there is only one way for the angels to find solace, which I have expressed like this. Human beings down on the earth, in their physical bodies, live with Christ thoughts, and those Christ thoughts shine up to the angels like a light. They have shown up to the angels like a light since the mystery of Golgotha. Human beings say, quote, "Christ has permeated us," and we can develop in such a way that Christ will live within us, not I, but Christ in me. The angels, on the other hand, say, quote, "Christ went away from within our sphere, but he shines up to us like so many stars in the Christ thoughts of individual people. We recognize him there. He has shone from earth since the mystery of Golgotha," close quote. There is a real relationship between the spiritual world and the human world. And this real relationship is also expressed in that the spiritual beings that inhabit the spiritual world around us can look in with pleasure and satisfaction on the thoughts that we have about their world. Only when we are able to think of them can they help us. Even if we do not reach the point of seeing into the spiritual world with clairvoyance, they can help us if we know about them. Help comes to us from the spiritual world when we study spiritual science. It is not just that we learn the knowledge, but the beings in the upper hierarchies themselves help us if we know about them. Moreover, when we face authority in this era, it is beneficial for us that we have supporting us not just our own human understanding, but also what the spiritual beings are able to affect in our understanding when we know about them. They enable us to judge with regard to authority. The spiritual world helps us. We need the spiritual world. We must know about it. We must take it in deliberately. This is the third impulse that must occur in the fifth post-Atlantean era. The first is human social understanding. The second is attainment of freedom of thought, and the third is living knowledge of the spiritual world through spiritual science. These three must be the greatest ideals for the fifth era. Social understanding must come to the field of social life. Freedom of thought must come to the field of religion and other areas of our life together. And spiritual knowledge must come to the field of knowledge. Social understanding, freedom of thought, spiritual knowledge. These are the three great objectives, impulses of this era. We must evolve under these lights because they are the proper lights for our time. Many people feel intensively that such a thing is necessary, that another way of living together must arise for people today, that other concepts must appear. But out of ignorance or unwillingness, they evade the consequences of this feeling recognition. We can see this in the circumstances in which some people find themselves in relation to the intention of spiritual science or anthroposophy. We need not even think of the malicious slander and libel against spiritual science, theosophy, or anthroposophy, or of what is maliciously pitted against them for whatever reason. We can think, rather, of the honorable will that is present in modern humanity, of the honorable will that aims to create impulses in people that are along the lines of the correct impulses for this era. Just think of how many reform, in quotes, people are appearing in various fields, how many social pastors, other kinds of social preachers, and still other kinds of social speakers from non-theological or non-religious circles. How all this occurs, and how it is often filled with the very best will. Life in our time pushes people to bring something forth. Goodwill is present frequently, and in those moments we want to look at what is goodwill, not what is ill will. But so long as this goodwill remains only in general talk, even if it is borne by such fervent feelings, then it is of no use, and the knowledge that can come only from spiritual science is not filled with the life necessary for the three great ideals to be realized: social understanding, social knowledge of human nature, freedom of thought, spiritual knowledge. But humanity's understanding of this in our time has not even begun, except for the small group that has formed within the spiritual scientific worldview. Today we are able to see many beautiful, noble insights in this direction. I would like to give you a taste of what happened to me by chance, as people say, but in reality through karma. I found a little book in a store window, which I bought because of the impression the title made on me. The book is about modern humanity, about what we are seeking and under what impressions modern human beings grow up. It mentions how much there is in the modern world, in the modern outside world, that helps modern humanity, that makes life comfortable for us, that makes life easy, and how life is a delight under the influence of certain amenities brought about recently by steam power and electricity. All that is mentioned. But then something profound is emphasized, that although modern humanity has entered a more frenzied, more eventful life than was the case in earlier times, our lives have become richer. All of this is mentioned with a certain joy, with a certain ardency. Exceptional spiritual events of recent times are described, and how modern humanity has it better in comparison to the duller, sadder, more instinctive life of earlier times. Then, what I previously indicated as difficulties of the fifth post-Atlantean era are also correctly described. The only thing the author does not recognize is that this springs forth directly from the singularity of this era and its requirement, the development of the consciousness soul. There is not clear, lucid clairvoyance here. That is what matters. But the author senses with an open heart. He writes, quote, "Strange, we were able to begin with joie de vivre, or joy of living, in describing the inner process of development of our time. But we must speak of penetrating inner spiritual poverty at the end of this period. What we experience here on a small scale, our time is experiencing on a large scale." Close quote. By, in quotes, "on a small scale," he means the specific place in which he lives. Quote, "A richness of culture without compare, a blossoming of life in power and beauty," as almost none other in history, and at the same time spiritual poverty that is mounting and that grips entire social classes." Close quote. And now, after having understood this correctly, this man explores possible causes that might have led to this condition, in order not just helplessly to present this spiritual poverty, but to find what is right, so that the recent impulses of humanity can be guided in the correct way. And among these various things, he also presents what he calls theosophy, and how he came to know about theosophy. Here, among so many antagonistic people, we come across someone who meets theosophy sympathetically, with the very best will, with the will to really get to know it. He did acquaint himself with it, and therefore we take him under consideration. I bring this up because it is really very important and fundamental that we also concern ourselves with such positive connections between our spiritual science and outer life. After this, man also speaks about what mysticism, which does not achieve actual mysticism, means to accomplish in deepening life and alleviating mental anguish. He says, quote, "In addition to mysticism, there is theosophy. There are some who see it only as a guise, out to put surrogates in place of proven forces, or who find only a penchant for syncretism and eclecticism in it," close quote. That is, a penchant for aggregating all sorts of religious denominations and worldviews. Those who do not go any more deeply into spiritual science talk about how warmed over Gnosticism is part of it, and so on. But this man goes a step further. He says to those, quote, "who find only a penchant for syncretism and eclecticism in it, corresponding to their individual tendencies, and throw it together with less lucid concomitant phenomena in contemporary life, with superstition, spiritism, visionaries, symbolism, and similar expressions of spiritual child's play that put people on edge with their secrecy," close quote, that this is not true. Quote, "It wrongs this movement when one does not acknowledge the deep inner connections and values that come to expression in it," close quote. Thus, here is a sympathetic person. He says, quote, "We must attempt to understand in it, at least in Steiner's circle, much more than one of the religious movements of our contemporaries, even if it is not of the original, but only the syncretic kind, but which is directed toward the basis of all life." Close quote. I hope he will also come to the originality of it, given how much goodwill this man has. Quote, "We may judge it as a movement to fulfill humanity's suprasensory interests, and thus as a surpassing of realism, which clings to the sense aspect. We may recognize in it, above all, a movement that points out to people the moral problems that they are confronted with for the purpose of self-consciousness, and that aims to work toward inner rebirth from a painstaking attention to self-education." Close quote. As I said, I am not reading this out of some foolish sentiment. It is not insignificant, given what else is said about anthroposophy, for us also to become familiar with such judgments. Quote, "One need only read Steiner's introduction to title Theosophy to see how seriously one is shown the work on moral purification and self-refinement. Further, it is a reaction to materialism, in its speculation directed at the supersensory, admittedly." Close quote, parenthesis, "and here is something to which I ask you to pay particular attention," close parenthesis, continue quote, "it loses its footing in reality a bit, and goes beyond its capacity into hypotheses, clairvoyant fantasies, a dream realm, so that there is insufficient force left for the reality of the individual and social lifestyle. But all the same, we want to record theosophy and must as a corrective phenomenon in contemporary educational development." Close quote. Thus, the only thing this man does not like is the ascent to spiritual knowledge, to concrete, real spiritual insight. That is, he wants to have the impulses for human moral perfection that can flow from theosophy, in his view as well, but he does not yet recognize that this can come, here in the fifth post-Atlantean era, only from true, concrete, spiritual knowledge. He does not recognize the roots. He wants to have the fruit without the roots. He does not recognize the whole interrelationship. This man is extraordinarily interesting because he studied my book, Theosophy, with dedication, as one can see. But he failed to see that the one does not exist without the other. He would like to chop the head off this book, but keep the body, as he sees the body as something of value. This is connected with what I described to you earlier. Such people already understand that social understanding and freedom of thought are necessary. But they do not yet want to acknowledge that the third ideal, spiritual knowledge, must form the basis for our era. That is what they cannot yet come around to. To inspire understanding for spiritual knowledge is one of the most important tasks of the stream of the spiritual scientific worldview. Many people call ascending to the spiritual worlds fanciful. They do not recognize that loss of knowledge of the spiritual world has been brought about directly by materialism, and the lack of social understanding associated with it by the materialistic life and life ethos of recent times. It is precisely those who are sympathetic whom we must study to see how it is still difficult for people today to recognize the necessity of definite spiritual worlds. Thus we must try all the more to gain understanding for such impulses as those of which I have spoken in today's lecture. The little book I have been talking about is titled The Thought World of the Educated, Problems and Questions. It had already been published in 1914 in Hamburg by the Rauhe Haus Agency. It reproduces a lecture given by Professor Dr. Friedrich Mahling at the 37th Convention for Inner Mission in Hamburg on September 23, 1913. As I said, it came into my hands entirely by chance a few days ago when I saw it in the window of a bookstore, and I can only wonder that no one in our circle noticed it. It could have fallen into someone's hands, since it has been published since 1914. It is actually necessary to concern ourselves specifically with the various threads running back and forth between many different fields. It is necessary to concern ourselves with one issue that we find so often, that of the vile railing against and ridicule of our movement. But we can also concern ourselves with the cases when honest understanding is sought, as in this case, when we can learn directly from the difficulties that people who are seeking honest understanding have today. This is exactly what I wanted to base today's lecture on, to show what the three great ideals should be, the concrete ideals for the fifth post-Atlantean era, concrete social human understanding, freedom of thought, spiritual knowledge. The three concrete ideals must give direction to the sciences in the future. They must purify and cleanse life, must give impulse to morality, must provide orientation and direction, must penetrate life, must foster life in the widest scope within modern humanity. But the first two challenges will not be fulfilled, social understanding and freedom of thought, if spiritual knowledge is not added to them as the third aspect, because the consciousness soul must be developed. The spirit self, which must be developed in the sixth post-Atlantean cultural period, is the highest level of this consciousness soul. It will not be developed if human beings do not prepare inner independence, which is achieved through the development of the consciousness soul. This is what we must also take into consideration in our spiritual scientific pursuit, that what we recognize as abstract truths really have magic powers, which we must unleash only in order to shine a bright light on all life. And wherever people find themselves in life, whether they are in a branch of science or some field of practical work, even in the smallest job. They will take part in the great tasks of our time, if they can give life to the abstract facts we talk about at our gatherings, in the sense that they should have life. Then cheerfulness will enter into people's souls, cheerfulness that is not just carefree superficiality, but that is also connected to the seriousness that supports life, that increases our powers, that does not just enable us to enjoy life, but makes us into competent workers in life. In this sense, the three social and cognitive ideals I have talked about will also give the consciousness soul the ability to understand the mystery of Golgotha, the ability to receive Christ into ourselves in a new way in this era. For we must establish a real bond with the spiritual worlds by coming to know how these worlds relate to this central impulse of earthly evolution and to the Christ impulse. Only then will the Christ impulse become an influence on the thoughts that have been able to shine into human souls in earth existence from the spiritual world since the mystery of Golgotha. Thoughts that can light up in human souls as bright, comforting stars, as I have described. Thoughts that themselves light up the world of the angels, who have lost the Christ from their spheres, so they see him shining back to them from the sphere of human thoughts. No, spirit knowledge is not something that may be described as fantasy. Spirit knowledge is what is striven for in order to find what can remedy the soul poverty that is necessarily linked to the fifth post-Atlantean era. That is what I wanted to speak to you about today. I hope we will see each other again in this city in the not-too-distant future. Until then, I hope that we remain connected in thought and also continue our work here in the spirit of our movement. The end of Lecture 4, translated by Aria Jackson.